What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Alan Weingrad, Super Bowl-winning NFL lineman and now an Orthodox Jew and motivational speaker. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@Yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. It's one of the loveliest times of the year here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live. The mornings are cool and refreshing. The days warm to just slightly above balmy. The evenings are pleasant and long. It's good to be alive, enjoying the autumn after our long, endless, hot summer, and to relish the fact that things will be pretty darn nice here in southern Arizona for the next 7 or 8 months. This is the time of year when we read Breishit in the Torah, some of the best material in the book of Genesis, and I promise it's great. In this week's Torah portion, Abraham, in those days simply known as Avram, Abram at the start, he's called by God, Lech Lecha, go, leave your land and your people and your home and journey to a land that I will show you, the land that will someday be Israel. Abram unflinchingly does just that, taking his wife Sarah and his household and setting off into the great unknown. It's a powerful example of blind faith in action. God says go, and Abram goes. In fact, it may be the last time a Jew took instructions without asking questions or raising objections or just plain fetching. Anyway, Jewish legend has long enjoyed elaborating on this story of Abraham. One of the most entertaining tales about this father of nations, that's what Abraham means in Hebrew, comes from a medieval song in the Sephardic Ladino language called Cuando el Rey Nimrod, perhaps the best known Spanish Jewish song of all. It tells the tale of Abraham's birth and circumcision, but in ways that differ from the story told in the Torah portion of Lech Lecha in many particulars. For example, Abraham is born in the song in the Jewish quarter. That would be quite a feat when you are the very first Jew ever. We'll play two versions of Cuando el Rey this morning. The first from my dad, Baruch Kohan's recording, We Wish You Love.
Cuando el Rey Nimrod al campo salía, miraba en el cielo y en la estrella. And
My favorite element in that song, Quando el Rey Nimrod, is the description of a star shining in the sky, indicating the birth of Abraham. That's a tale probably borrowed back from the Christian culture in which some Spanish Jews of the Middle Ages lived. Also, Abraham, in the Torah, was circumcised at the age of 90 years old, not on the eighth day, and it's a requirement established for Abraham's son Isaac in this week's Torah portion that it be on the eighth day, and commanded for all Jewish boys ever since. But in the song, Quando el Rey Nimrod, that my dad just sang, it says that Abraham himself was circumcised on the eighth day, an error of about 90 years or so. Look, listen, we Jews have always known that you never let historical accuracy get in the way of a good tune. Circumcision is the subject of many jokes and some discomfort, but it's also the fundamental Jewish covenant, the Brit, often called just a bris, which means not circumcision, but covenant. Abraham is commanded by God to walk before me and be whole, tamim, implying that becoming whole means making a physical sign of the covenant, visible. As usual, I'm tempted here on Too Jewish to segue into a series of moil jokes. You know, the moil is the one who does the circumcision. Do you know what a moil brings to a circumcision? A brisket. Or what do you serve at the meal after a bris? Cold cuts. I know somebody who served pizza and invited everyone to come by for a slice. Yep, that's it. Circumcision. A real slice of life. Sorry, I guess I should really cut this out. In any case, to redeem the show this morning, we will shortly welcome our guest, Alan Weingrad, who goes by the name of Shlomo nowadays. He was an NFL offensive lineman who won a Super Bowl ring and then made a dramatic life turn. Find out what it was and why he did it when we return on Too Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. This spring, Mama's Pizza was invited to be a food vendor at the Sunday night Tucson Pops concerts at Reed Park. Well, this fall, we had the honor of being invited back. I guess that even in the middle of a park, people can't resist fresh hot pizza when it's made with the best ingredients available and served at a value price. Go figure. But I gotta tell you, even after all these years, when I bite into a fresh hot slice of Mama's Pizza, I always start to hear beautiful music in my head. You see, it's not just me. I bet you hear it too. The truth is, delicious pizza, heroes, calzones, pasta, and desserts will always be music to your ears when you visit one of our four locations. Check them out at mamasfamous.com. Now you know the drill. Repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Alan Weingrad. He's a motivator, entertainer, and businessman. He is quite likely the only former NFL player in history and Super Bowl winner to become an observant Orthodox Jew. His story is a very interesting one, and he now speaks about it kind of all around the world. Good morning, Alan. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
So should I call you Alan or Shlomo?
I think Shlomo. I think when you call the Hebrew name, it brings the holiness down. So hopefully we have some holiness on the call with us.
From your mouth to God's ears. Tell us a little bit about your story. You started out as a long shot to make the NFL. You played for 7 years. Tell us about your own religion, your own Jewish background to start with.
Sure. I think I'm your typical American Jew, where the bar mitzvah is the exit out of Judaism, not the entrance into Judaism. You know, through my travels over the years, I met so many people that when I'm speaking or we're interacting, many times it's, you know, I had a very similar upbringing as you did, where it was a real workout to go to synagogue. It was a real struggle to go through Hebrew school, because it just wasn't fun and exciting. Certainly today it's presented differently. There's more fun and passion associated with it, from my experience and what I've seen with my own children. So, you know, my mom of blessed memory would light candles on Friday nights, and she'd do everything she could to bring the family together for a Seder, light candles for Hanukkah, and give us presents for Hanukkah. And perhaps the biggest thing was really around the food and the holiday. There wasn't much of spirituality or words of Torah. It was really about the family getting together.
So there's nothing wrong with the family getting together, but obviously sports probably had a higher priority in your life than Judaism.
Well, that's for sure. You know, my having, you know, two big kids being raised in a house, and every time we would fight, things would break. My dad realized very quickly that he had to get us out of the house, so he bought football equipment. And, you know, at the age of six, and my brother was eight at the time, he got us an organized football. And, you know, very quickly, my mom didn't really have much say, as it was really three against one. And my brother and I just kept on playing over the years. And many times we would go to shul on Rosh Hashanah, but we'd also go to football practice in the afternoon. And that seemed to be a common theme, you know, through the early years. And then obviously when we got into college, it was just kind of like a distant memory. There wasn't much of anything that I was doing. Certainly, you know, going to school at East Texas State University, which was, you know, quite a distance from Dallas, you know, where there was a Jewish community, nothing was happening on the campus. So I focused, you know, very much on my education and on the possibility of playing the NFL.
We will talk more about how your NFL career evolved, and then the changes you made as you became observant after winning a Super Bowl. We'll continue with Alan Weingrad when we come back on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime by directing your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations who provide scholarships for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade to go to qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel's Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Join over 750 supporters last year who gave money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income tax. New this year, there's an additional tax credit, the Switcher Credit. It increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,003 for single filers and $2,006 for married couples filing jointly. When we fight every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to foster a Jewish identity for our community's kids. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive financial aid in order to get a Jewish education. Call 647-8442, again, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Give the gift of education. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us from there or at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. And here is our weekly 2012 presidential election campaign Jewish moment. Florida may again be a hotspot in this election campaign, as it was famously in the 2000 and even the 2004 campaigns. Its 29 electoral votes will make a huge difference in who becomes president next January. With Jewish voters clustered in just a few counties and with Jews voting at a much higher percentage than other voters, the importance in this race of Jews is magnified. Both sides are counting Florida's Jewish voters very hard and courting them as well. President Obama may not have visited Israel since he was elected, but he has certainly been to Florida, as have many of his surrogates within the Jewish community. And Mitt Romney's campaign has been working extremely hard to try to woo an extra 5 or 10% of Jewish voters into the Republican fold. Billboards abound in Florida reading, "Vote for Mitt. It's a mitzvah." Clever. Or, "Bubbies for Barack." Each and every election cycle, Republicans say this will be the year the Jews swing more conservative, but it doesn't really happen. In 2008, Republican presidential nominee John McCain, a tremendous supporter of Israel, received just 23% of the Jewish vote, according to research by the Solomon Project, a civic-minded American Jewish organization. Recent polls suggest not much has changed. An early September survey of registered Jews in Florida by the American Jewish Committee, a Jewish advocacy group, found that 69% support Obama and 25% support Romney. Not very different. Republican leaders in Palm Beach County and neighboring Broward, home to an estimated 170,000 Jews, say Romney needs to pull about 35 to 40% of the Jewish vote in those regions to win the state. Local Democrats insist that number is just pie in the sky. I don't know, maybe it's knish in the sky? And that while Jewish Republicans are more vocal and better funded this year than ever, their totals are still likely to remain stagnant in the vote. This whole election may come down to a few huge Jewish condo complexes of retirees near Boca Raton. We could see a new refrain in American politics: as goes Boca, so goes the nation. Well, we'll find out in a few more weeks. That was our campaign 2012 Jewish election moment. As they say in Chicago, vote early and vote often. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Weintraub Israel Center here in Tucson. Boker Tov, Guy. Good morning.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Well, we have a wonderful visitor coming to us, but he's renowned for a variety of reasons. Former Ambassador Itamar Rabinovich is going to be here. Tell us a little bit about Rabinovich. He's been a former guest of Two Jewish about a year ago. What's he here for, and what's he going to talk about?
Yes, indeed. It's a very exciting visit by former Israeli Ambassador Itamar Rabinovich. Itamar was the Israeli ambassador to the United States. He was also the official chief negotiator with Syria during the mid-1990s and the former president of the Tel Aviv University at the years 1999 and 2007. Professor Rabinovich is considered to be one of the primary experts on Middle East issues and the Israeli-Arab conflict. He's coming to Tucson in order to do several talks. One of them, our main event, would be on Monday, October 29th at 7 p.m. at the JCC. It will be free and open to all. And he will talk at that event mainly about this triangle of relationships between Israel, the United States, and Iran, with the Iranian nuclear threat coming up, with all those debates between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Obama and all the politics around that. And to a degree, he will try to put some order into all this mishmash of talks, threats, and so on.
Red lines, dotted lines, very hard to say.
Yes, indeed. And you know, I think Professor Rabinovich is really one of the experts that that one would want to hear about those subjects. He really knows the materia. He's not, I wouldn't define him as the biggest supporter of Netanyahu. He's more, to my perspective, comes maybe from a Labor Party background, although he might disagree with me. But I think he's...
Being Jewish and an Israeli, he probably would disagree with you.
But. Yeah, but I think his analysis of the situation in general would be very, very interesting and very academic. He comes with a lot of knowledge.
He's an excellent academic, renowned actually, in Israel and around the world. Is he going to talk about Syria also, which is a flashpoint that somehow has disappeared from the media, but there's still basically a civil war going on there?
Indeed. Syria is not formally the topic of the talk, but one can assume that once we'll open the ground for questions and answers, this topic will come into the discussion. I don't think one today can refer to the Iranian issue without referring to Syria, without referring to the Arab Spring, without referring to the awkward fact, I might say, that in Syria today we are seeing thousands of civilians slaughtered by their own government, and the world basically does nothing, at least not anything that we can see. There are some reports about, you know, assistance in weapons and stuff that are giving from the West to the rebels and go, you know, back and forth. And it's a very complicated situation.
So people can come here. Ambassador Itamar Rabinovich, give us the date and time and place one more time.
It would be Monday, October 29th at 7 p.m. at the JCC. It is free and open to all.
Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So the holidays are now in our rearview mirror, and we can talk a little bit about maybe some after effects. And you had some, afterthoughts about the whole sacred experience of the elaborate fall holiday season.
Right. I think one of the things about the high holiday experience is that it's too condensed and too concentrated. And we all end up, frankly, being sick of all the holidays in a row in such a dense period.
It's just too Jewish, really.
Well, funny coincidence there. But when we think about some of the themes, obviously they're themes that are meant to be valid and important all year round. And the problem for many of us is that we approach certain Jewish activities because we grow up in a Christian world with speaking a Christian language with conceptual categories that really express Christian concepts rather than Jewish concepts. So we translate tefillah as prayer, which means begging, really, and it's not. We translate teshuvah as repentance, which is a lot like the penitent monks in the Middle Ages, and it's not. It's really like a return. But we don't think in those terms. We think in the terms we learned as 5- and 6-year-olds in Sunday school or Hebrew school or wherever our early Jewish education came from. And so we often don't approach the most important Jewish activities in a very adult or thoughtful or Jewish way. And you know, I read a couple of interesting things about the notion of teshuvah, which we wrongly translate as repentance. And one of the concepts I really liked that I wanted to maybe discuss with you and share our discussion with your listeners is a concept of sacred discontent, of sort of looking at the world as our ancestor Abraham did and figuring, you know, not all is right. We worship all these gods. All our neighbors worship all these gods. We should be worshiping one God. or whatever else, however we define the way the world ought to be, and realizing that the way the world ought to be is different from the way the world is. And the sacred aspect comes in the sense that we don't define the world as it ought to be the way Tevye the dairyman does in the Shalom Aleichem stories of, I'm richer, I have a bigger house, I have an easier life, I'm better looking, whatever. We define the world as it ought to be, as the kind of place in which we would wish to live, the kind of place that God wants us to transform the world into. So we recognize the world as it is with its flaws, but we also see the world as it can be, and we challenge ourselves, and this might be one of the true meanings of Teshuvah, to play a more active role in expressing our discontent by transforming the world from the way it actually is to the way we feel it can and should be. And the process of defining that and our role in that process and our possible contribution to that transformation, I think, is one of the lasting challenges that we come away from this season with.
You know, I come back to a non-religious statement, Theodor Herzl's Im Tirtzu Ein Zo Agada, if you will it, it is no dream. If you conceive of the world as a better place, you can also make it happen, which is maybe that sacred discontent turned into action. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. The Italian says, I'm tired and thirsty, I must have wine. The Frenchman says, I'm tired and thirsty, I must have cognac. The Russian said, I'm tired and thirsty, I must have vodka. The German says, I'm tired and thirsty, I must have beer. The Mexican says, I'm tired and thirsty, I must have tequila. And the Jew says, I'm tired and thirsty, I must have diabetes. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature to Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and not get diabetes. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Lech Lecha, which includes God's great commandment to Abram, Lech Lecha mi'artzecha u'mimolatetcha u'mibeit avicha, leave. Go from your country and your homeland and the house of your father to a land that I will show you. It's the beginning of monotheism, of the belief in one God. It's the beginning of Judaism, and it will prove to be the beginning of our connection to the land of Israel as well, a dramatic and powerful moment. The fascinating thing about Lech Lecha is not that God commands Abram, later to be renamed Abraham, to leave everything he's known. After all, if he is to create a new religion and remake belief in our world, he will need to leave polytheism in a pagan society that doesn't recognize the concept of supreme justice and divine power. He must leave this corrupt, dishonest, and ethically failed civilization. So if you want to live a life of goodness and blessing, sometimes you need to leave home to do it. Abraham picked up and left the sophisticated, morally challenged city-states of Babylon and journeyed outwards to find God and to found a new religion. That journey of differentiation was pivotal to all human history. If Abraham doesn't just do what God commands, there will be no Judaism, or Christianity, or Islam, or monotheism, or really Western civilization. But what's most fascinating about Abraham's actions in this week's Torah portion of Lech Lecha is that after God commanded him to go, he simply went, without argument or controversy. That strikes me as not a very Jewish approach. After all, the essence of Jewish culture seems to be argument and discussion to find the truth. If you were directed to leave everything you've ever known and told to move somewhere unspecified, wouldn't you at least complain a little? And please don't think Abraham is incapable of arguing with God. In fact, he proves in next week's Torah portion that he will argue and bargain with God to the last degree, as he does trying to defend the few righteous people of Sodom and Gomorrah. No, something else is at work. The essential understanding that we all have that sometimes you just have to move on, leave what you know, embrace the journey. In order to fully realize who we can become, we must first leave who we have been. It's an exciting, exhilarating, daunting prospect, dangerous, yet essential. And if we can choose to take the first steps, we may, like Abraham, reap rich reward. Our Jewish poetry slam this morning comes from the great Yiddish poet Yaakov Glotstein. It's based on this week's Torah portion of Lech Lecha, God's call to Abraham to seek a new land under God's direction. The poem is called Genesis. Why don't we start all over again with a small people, out of the cradle and little? The two of us, wanderers over the nations, tillers of the soil, will bow before you. You'll live on burnt offerings of grain. I'll go around preaching folk wisdom. It won't reach past our borders, but the least little child will greet me good morning. Why don't we both go home and start over, from the very beginning, out of our littleness? Almighty God, who has waxed great over the seven firmaments and continents, swollen steel strong in vast churches and synagogues, Lord of the universe, you've deserted field and barn. I, the close love of my people, we've both turned universal. Come back, dear God, to a land no bigger than a speck. Dwindle down to only ours. I'll go around with homely sayings, suitable for chewing over in small places. We'll both be provincial, God and his poet. Maybe it will go sweeter for us. Come back. Be our Jewish God again. That was our Jewish Poetry Slam from poet Yaakov Glotstein, translated by the great author Cynthia Ozick. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Alan Weingrad, former Super Bowl winning offensive lineman with the Dallas Cowboys, will explain why he became a Baal Tshuva and embraced an Orthodox Jewish lifestyle when his playing days were over. Learn more when we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
My favorite moment of this whole election season came in Southern California last week at a debate at Pierce College between two Jewish U.S. House of Representative members, Congressman Howard Berman, 71 years old, a 14-term member of Congress, and Congressman Brad Sherman, 57 years old, an 8-term incumbent. Redistricting has dumped these two successful politicians into the same district in the San Fernando Valley of L.A., and with California's weird the top two face-off rule that pitted two Democratic incumbents head-to-head, and in the heat of this tough contest to retain their seats, these two guys faced off in a debate that became much more intense than the presidential ones. In the interest of full disclosure, I must tell you that Congressman Howard Berman attended my high school, Alexander Hamilton High in L.A., as well as my alma mater, UCLA, although long before I went to either one. In any case, as these two longtime California Jewish politicos squared off, Brad Sherman, the younger and larger of the two, at one point actually put his arm forcefully around Howard Berman's shoulder and said, "You want to get into this?" And a security guard came up just in case he had to separate the two. Very classy. Their mothers must be so proud, especially Sherman's. Well, we'll see who wins this election in a few weeks, but the YouTube video is, in a weird way, kind of funny. What is this, Jew versus Jew in the octagon? Who knew? And in other Jewish political news, moderate Senator Arlen Specter, who served 31 years as a senator from Pennsylvania, most of it as a Republican, died last week. Arlen Specter grew up as the only Jew in his class in Russell, Kansas, eventually transferred to the University of Pennsylvania, and became a tough prosecuting attorney. Specter had a long, colorful career. It ranged from his service on the Warren Commission investigating John F. Kennedy's assassination. He was the one who proposed the single bullet theory. He was actually put on that commission by Gerald Ford. Specter was elected to the Senate as a maverick, became the longest tenured Pennsylvania senator ever, opposed the impeachment of President Bill Clinton, and became chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Arlen Specter was involved in many controversies. As a moderate Republican, he opposed Robert Bork as a nominee to the Supreme Court, but grilled Anita Hill during the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings. Specter began his career as a Democrat, became a Republican to run against the Democratic machine in Pennsylvania, and finally, at the end of his time in the Senate, switched back to being a Democrat, helping to pass President Barack Obama's health care bill. But one thing was always certain with Arlen Specter, may he rest in peace. Throughout his long career, he was always a strong, effective, and deeply dedicated supporter of Israel. May his memory be a blessing. After a long, strange journey that can only be described as Kafkaesque, an unseen treasure of writings by the great surrealist author Franz Kafka will be put on display and eventually online, an Israeli court ruled. Ownership of the Kafka papers had been in dispute after the Israeli National Library claimed them over the wishes of two sisters who inherited the vast collection of rare documents from their mother and wanted to keep them. The ruling by the Tel Aviv District Family Court ordered the collection to be transferred to the library in Jerusalem, which had argued that Max Brod, Kafka's close friend, had bequeathed the manuscripts to the library in his will. The two sisters, Eva Hoffi and Ruth Wiesler, had inherited the documents from their mother, Broad's secretary, and had been storing them in a Tel Aviv apartment and in bank vaults. Kafka, the Jewish Prague native who wrote in German, is known for his dark tales of everyman protagonists crushed by mysterious authorities or twisted by unknown shame. His works have become classic, like The Metamorphosis, in which a salesman wakes up transformed into a giant beetle, and The Trial, where a bank clerk is put through an excruciating trial without ever being told the charges against him. The trove is said to include Broad's personal diary and some of Kafka's writings, including correspondence the two kept with other notable writers, which could shed new light on one of literature's most influential figures. The German Literary Archive was not part of the legal proceedings, but had backed the sisters' claims, hoping to buy the manuscripts and arguing that they belong in Germany. Ulrich Rauf, who heads the archive, said the papers have drawn great interest because they will likely reveal much about the years in Kafka's life that the public knows very little about. "I hope that the Israeli National Library will provide open access to the material for the public as soon as possible," he said. Researchers have been waiting for the material with excitement for years. Kafka gave his writings to Broad shortly before his own death from tuberculosis in 1924, instructing his friend to burn everything. But Broad instead published most of the material, including the novels The Trial, The Castle, and America. Thank goodness he did. Aviad Stolman, the Judaica Collections Curator at the Israeli National Library, said the majority of the manuscripts are by Broad, not Kafka, but they contain tremendous research and sentimental value. Despite the ruling, Hoffe will be entitled for royalties from any future publication of the documents. Professor Otto Dovkolka, a self-described Kafkaphile, retired professor of history at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, supported the court decision. "The National Library is taking care of Einstein's theory of relativity, and we will now take care of the great works of Kafka," he said. And finally, believe it or not, yet another Nobel Prize this year awarded to a Jewish recipient. Americans Alvin Roth and Lloyd Shapley were awarded the Nobel Economics Prize last week for research that helps explain the market processes at work when doctors are assigned to hospitals, students to schools, and human organs for transplant to recipients. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, that is the Nobel people, cited the two economists for the theory of stable allocations and the practice of market design. Roth is a professor at Harvard University in Boston. He is 60. Shapley is a professor emeritus at UCLA. He's 89. Roth is Jewish. He said he was sleeping when he got the call from the Nobel Committee. I'm sure that in class this morning, my students will pay more attention, he said. Indeed. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. He's Alan Weingrad, an NFL lineman, played both for the Packers and the Cowboys, two iconic teams, won a Super Bowl in Super Bowl 27, and then became an Orthodox Jew. We were talking a little bit about how your journey led you into college. In college, you were playing ball and getting an education at East Texas State. Not, by the way, a renowned feeder system for the NFL, East Texas State. You must have been a long shot to make an NFL roster in the first place. Tell us about that part of the journey. And there, as you said, you weren't doing very much that was Jewish.
Right, for sure. I mean, that was a long shot to even make it into college, to play on a college team. But really, through my mother's prowess, she helped market me to a college, and I had more success in track and field as a discus and shot put thrower, so it took a real chance on me as I had some athletic skills, throwing as opposed to playing football. But I started to blossom, you know, after my sophomore year, and it was really the head football coach there that said to me, you've developed yourself at an incredible level the last 2 years. And if you keep continuing on this pace, the NFL is going to come and they're going to grab you. You might want to start to get yourself ready for it. And when he said that to me, it was like, wow, are you kidding me, coach? And so from that point on, it was like everything I was doing, it was preparing for the NFL. However, unfortunately, I was cut by two teams my first time trying. And then it was really a year later that I asked my agent to contact the Packers, and they signed me to a free agent league minimum contract. And through a tremendous off-season program that they had prior to the start of training camp, I was able to become what I call a smarter football player by learning those techniques that are crucial to play at that next level.
And you made the Packers. How long were you with the Packers?
Yeah, I was with the Packers for five seasons, and I was certainly fortunate my first year that I had the ability to start every game. Through my play, them getting tired of a veteran that was asking for a lot of money, somebody retiring, and they were looking to make significant changes to the roster, which gave me, you know, a lot of hands-on experience very, very early on in a career.
So, the Packers, one of the real iconic franchises in the NFL. You played starter for them for years. That's at the highest level of football. What was your Jewish activity like in those days?
Well, you know, as soon as I made the Packers, literally the day they announced I made the Packers, and it was broadcasted, the final roster on the local Green Bay paper, the Press Gazette, a local businessman contacted me at the locker room. A call came through and a phone message was left, and I went over to my locker after practice, and it was, you know, addressed to me to call Lou Weinstein with a local Green Bay number. Well, I don't know Lou Weinstein. I don't know anybody in Green Bay except for the 50-something guys in the locker room, coaches and trainers. And so I felt like I know this guy's Jewish based on his name. Let me call him. I call this guy up, and he says, welcome to town. Can I buy you lunch? And I was a little hesitant in accepting the lunch, but I did for whatever reason. And he took me out to his country club, and we had lunch, and he just wanted to say, welcome to town. What can I do for you? How can I help you? Where are you staying? Do you know anything about investing money? Where are you going to be in 2 weeks? Because it's Rosh Hashanah, and I'd like for you to come to the synagogue with me and my family and then come back to my house for lunch.
So the Jewish network started working as soon as you made the Packers.
As soon as I made the Packers, Jewish network started working. Now, I didn't do much more than go to synagogue with him once or twice because it just did not work with the NFL schedule. But I will assure you that that was a family to me, that if I needed anything, I'd make that phone call. And we'd stayed in touch for many, many years until his passing. And over the years that I was playing for the Packers, his son took me fishing and took me duck hunting and showed me some of the outdoor life that Wisconsin has to offer, as well as Thanksgiving place at the table. And I truly felt like I was a part of their whole family.
So you played for the Packers, established yourself in Green Bay, and eventually ended up on the Cowboys. Tell us how that came about.
Well, I was very happy playing for the Packers and very happy in Wisconsin. You know, as an offensive lineman, we run very well in cold weather. You get us into the heat, you know, we run out of gas pretty quickly. And
something about the size of you guys, it's different in hot.
Oh yeah, we are. That's the first thing you look at, is you look at the schedule and you see where it's going to be hot early in the year, because you don't want to come play in Miami in September. Even though I'm a Miami person, I know that experience. So I wasn't too keen on going to play for the Dallas Cowboys for a number of reasons. One, because of the location. Secondly, they play on AstroTurf. And thirdly, they had a difficult coach by his reputation by the name of Jimmy Johnson. However, my sports agent was able to get me a much better contract, what I had, and I still turned it down. And then he said to me the following. He said, you know, Alan, there's a very small Jewish community in Green Bay and a much larger one in Dallas, and you're getting older and uglier. You may want to come to Dallas and see if you can find yourself a wife. And because I was Steve's only Jewish client, and my agent was also Jewish.
Of course.
He knew the importance of, right, exactly.
The agents are Jewish, not the players so much. Okay.
Right. But he knew the importance of marrying Jewish, as we've had those discussions. And so I accepted the offer and played for the Cowboys for 2 years.
So what changed for you? Because obviously when you're playing for the Cowboys, you weren't, as the saying goes, a Torah observant Jew. You weren't, Shomer Shabbat. I'm sure that wasn't a possibility even. Tell us about the transformational experience that you had.
Well, you know, I got married soon after the Super Bowl and retired 6 months later. I moved back to South Florida. Just started living the life that anybody would want to live. Kind of keeping up with the Joneses, living on a golf course, playing golf, fishing, you know, working out a little bit, really enjoying the fruits of my labor. And Judaism was not on really the radar screen for me. That's kind of the life that I lived. You know, I was, it just wasn't that much of a priority. And it really wasn't until the second year of retirement, after our first child was born, when I received a phone call from a cousin. Actually a distant cousin who's a doctor in the South Florida area, who gave me medical advice on my injuries over the years. And I know he's an Orthodox Jew, and he said, you know, me and my family, we haven't seen you in a few years and we'd like to catch up. Why don't you come for a Friday night supper? And I accepted. So I loaded my wife and my daughter up and went to his house, from my house in Fort Lauderdale to his house in Miami Beach. And he's a nice man. And I didn't know him very well. I only knew really his medical side. But I knew he was a Torah observant Jew. So we went to his house, and I was just like, I was wowed by the cuisine and the abundance and how delicious everything was and how homemade everything was. And then after the supper, he says to me, as he saw that I couldn't say anything, I couldn't add anything, I didn't know anything, he said, would you be interested in going to a Torah class? And my immediate response wanted to be no, like, what's the point? But I said yes, for whatever reason. I said, I'll go to one. And it was probably out of respect to my cousin. And a week later, a rabbi called me and said, there's a class that's going to be given in your community at somebody's home. And gave me the address, and I went to the class.
And you liked it?
Well, the first 59 and a half minutes, I was really focused on the particular location of the class, as it was in a very successful doctor's home, and I was just kind of oohed and awed by the makings of the home and what was inside the home. And I was obviously focused very much on materialism. And we get right to the end of the class, the last 30 seconds, the rabbi ties in how materialism will lead you to a non-meaningful life, a non-purposeful life. And I just was like, I had to stop him at the end of the class. I said, Rabbi, what were you saying? And how are you talking about meaning and purpose and materialism, and how they, and how if you focus on the materialism, you can't have a meaningful, purposeful life. And he said to me, "You don't have any books on Torah, do you?" I said, "No, I never studied the Torah. I don't know anything about it." And he says, "It's a roadmap to life." So I said, "Well, I'd like to come to another class, but I thought the Torah is just a very long history book about the Jewish people wandering through the desert." And he said, "Well, it does tell us the story, but it's filled and packed with inspiration." And that's when I got my attention. I said, "Inspiration is what I'm interested in." So I went to my next class, and I went on this journey with this rabbi, and I'm still on it, and he's still a close friend of mine. However, I met other rabbis along the way, and they inspired me differently. And after about 10 years of that first Torah class, I just realized that, and for truly to have a meaningful life, not just on Friday night, you got to live this. It's not just a Friday night experience. It's a 7-day-a-week experience, 24 hours a day. When we get up, we say, "Thank you, God, for restoring our soul," and we drink a glass of water, and we're thinking about things in a very different way.
What's similar about football and an observant Jewish life?
It's interesting that people that interview me always ask that question. They seem to pick up on it. There is a lot of similarities. For example, as an athlete, you get up in the morning and you prepare yourself and you get out of the house and you immediately go to the locker room and you start getting ready for the day. Whether it's getting ready for practice, getting ready for the meetings, getting ready for the weight room. And in Jewish life, it's the same thing. You get up in the morning, you grab your talis and tefillin, which now is the equipment, and you go to synagogue, and there's camaraderie, and there's discipline, and there's structure, and it takes effort, and it takes work to feel the prayers, to feel what's going on in the weekly Torah portion. So I think there's a lot of similarities. And for me, I feel like it was very easy because I was so used to a structure for so many years in the world of football with a playbook, i.e. the Torah, with a calendar or with the schedule and an itinerary. And you knew exactly what to do on a daily basis. And this lifestyle lends itself to a very similar experience.
How many Jewish guys did you meet in the NFL?
Well, I'll tell you what's amazing. During my 7 years in the NFL, it just seems like the magic number is five. Five players that are in the NFL that are Jewish.
At any one time.
that I could recognize, that the Jewish press would send me a clipping highlighting the Jewish players. And what's so amazing to me, when the games ended, I was usually stretching my neck looking for that other Jew, and he was doing the same thing. So over those years, I would meet, you know, every third or fourth week, I would meet perhaps another Jewish player just to say hello, have a good season. If I knew, you know, Shalom Aleichem, I would have said Shalom Aleichem, but I didn't really know that back in those days. And there was a few coaches that I knew along the way that were Jewish that would look to say hello to me as well. So there was a small fraternity in the National Football League, and you know, every year there was a small fraternity.
You can find out more about Alan Weingrad and his story, and have him come speak for you. It's Alan Weingrad, VEINGRAD.com. That's about the right way to reach you, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the best way people can reach me on my website. There's a place to contact me for comments, to inquire about speaking, or to share anything they would like.
Alan, thank you for a great visit here on Two Jewish. It's a pleasure.
My pleasure. It was great. Thank you. I wish you all the best.
You too. Kol Tuv. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be historian John Davis, author of The Jews of San Nicandro, the amazing Jewish converts of southern Italy who became Jewish out of religious commitment during Mussolini's fascist reign over Italy They survived Nazi occupation of their region, and after liberation and the end of World War II, formally converted en masse to Judaism. It's a wild story. Our playout this morning comes from Israeli classic pop star Yehoram Gaon, another version of the classic Sephardic song for circumcision, Quando Orei Nimrod, a song of Abraham on this week of his coming out party in the Torah in Lech Lecha. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Quando l'Orei Nimrod al campo salia, mirava en el cielo y en la estrería. Vido luz santa en la juderia que había de nacer Abraham Avinu. Abraham Avinu, padre querido, padre bendito, luz de Israel. Abraham Avinu, padre querido, padre bendito, luz de Israel. La mujer de Terach quedó preñada de día en día, él le preguntaba de qué tenés la cara tan demudada. Ella ya sabía el bien que tenía.